And we'd like to please give a big round of applause to tonight's featured speaker, Adam T. from Los Angeles.
Thanks. My name's Adam. I'm an alcoholic. Things don't always go as planned. Want to thank you for inviting me. Thank the committee for all your hospitality. Want to welcome anybody that's new. If you're trying AA one more time, if you don't want to be here tonight, if you don't think Alcoholics Anonymous will work for you, if you think this is all a big misunderstanding, you know, I didn't get to AA because I had a bad weekend. You know, I had a couple of bad decades. And for me, like a lot of us, if you're new, this eventually became a matter of life and death. I was talking earlier today at a workshop, and you know every meeting has their perpetual chip taker. I mean, we all see people like that, and I did that walk of shame over and over and over. I stood up for 17 years as a newcomer. I had so many chips and key tags, it became ridiculous. I remember one secretary saying, "Give them back." You know, and I thank God for the unconditional love of the old-timers. I mean, as a newcomer with all that guilt and shame, what I would do is I would go into your head and I would look back at myself and I would think, what a loser. My goodness, why can't you get this? What's wrong with you? And I know the old-timers were judging me. You know, if you're new, we're judging. I mean, I was in a home group where they make bets. I'm not that spiritual. I mean, I love it when they say, don't judge anybody in AA. You guys ever hear that? And then what do they tell you 5 minutes later? Stick with the winners. I mean, I was so confused as a newcomer. I remember sitting in my counselor's office in detox, and, you know, I'm across this long table, and I've got the shakes, and he looks at me and he says, now, don't make any major changes in your first year. So I come to AA, get a sponsor. What's the first thing he tells me? You got to change everything. Sound familiar? Don't make any major decisions in your first year. Anybody seen the third step? How about don't get in a relationship in your first year? No one knows if that works. No one's ever done it. I know, I always look for the people that aren't smiling. There's always a saint in the crowd, right? If you got a halo, don't let it choke you. I was talking earlier, and I was saying that the one I really love is God doesn't give us more than we can handle. And you know, if I really believe that statement, if I really believe that God didn't give me more than I can handle, I wouldn't need God's help. And if you're new, the longer I've been sober, the longer I've been separated from alcohol, the more I've had to come to terms with the fact that I desperately need God's help. If you're new, I need your help. And help is the dirtiest four-letter word in Alcoholics Anonymous. The hardest thing for most of us to do was to admit complete defeat. If I really look at my life today, I would say that Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me what I could never do for myself. It has done for us as a fellowship and as a society what many of us could never do on our own. And if I lived to be 100 years old, I could never pay Alcoholics Anonymous back for that simple gift. And you know, like I said, with all this guilt and shame, I started coming to meetings drunk. Now, the interesting thing about AA these days, you see a guy drunk in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, people say stuff like, oh my gosh, what's he doing here? I mean, think about it. You know, with the event of treatment, okay, treatment, which is kind of like this multi-billion dollar empire that's grown up about AA, that kind of swoops us up in our most desperate moments, you know, throws us into yoga class. Craft hour. I'm making like belt buckles and bongs. Nature walks. You know, but what I'd do is I'd go to 7-Eleven, I'd get a big gulp cup, I'd fill it up with liquor, put a little Coca-Cola on top, and then I'd cruise into the late night Hollywood candlelight meeting. You know, do some of my best sharing. I know, they didn't think that was funny. Then I started going through treatment centers, and I remember being a teenager in Alcoholics Anonymous, and There's a section in the Big Book in the chapter to wives that talks about four specific types of alcoholics, and it actually enumerates them: type 1, type 2, type 3. And the fourth type of alcoholic in that chapter is the type of alcoholic that's been placed in one institution after another, that typically drinks on his way home from the hospital. And somehow that's what I had become. By the time I finally got sober, I'd gone through treatment 28 times. I know, not 28 days like the movie. This isn't Hollywood. 28 consecutive times. And I wore that like a badge of honor. I thought that's what made me an alcoholic. And I remember telling my sponsor, hey, you know, I went through treatment 28 times. I was hoping that would, like, get rid of the guy, you know, loser. And he looks me right in the eye and he says, you know, that doesn't make you an alcoholic. And I thought, you're kidding. He says, no, it means you paid $500,000 for a Big Book. And I didn't think that was funny either. And I'm not going to start citing and quoting pages tonight out of the Big Book, but page 101 of the Big Book says any scheme that attempts to shield the alcoholic from temptation is doomed to failure. See, treatment was a great place to fatten me up for another run, but treatment never solved the problem. And as an alcoholic, like so many of us, I always thought the problem was alcohol. I'd been hearing that since I was in eighth grade. Why do you drink so much? Why don't you just stop drinking? Why don't you slow down? I always thought the problem was alcohol. And I remember a guy in AA saying to me, Adam, if alcohol's your problem, that drink, that shot glass, that 12-pack, if that's your problem, you're probably not an alcoholic. And then in the very next breath, he says to me, and if you are in fact an alcoholic, the type that's described in the doctor's opinion, in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, your problem isn't alcohol. And you know what? It took me another decade to understand what that guy was trying to tell me. It was like some cruel riddle. I drank over that for years. But when I got around a home group that asked me some very specific questions about my relationship to alcohol, I started to see the truth about my relationship to booze. And one of those truths was that even as a little kid, as a teenage alcoholic, I was never able to live with alcohol. Even from eighth grade, I was already peeing in my pants. I was already drooling on my desk. I was already passed out under the bleachers. My nickname in eighth grade was Space Cadet. I couldn't find homeroom. People are picking high schools, I'm picking rehabs. Everyone could see I couldn't live with alcohol. But alcoholism comes in people. It doesn't come in bottles or 12-packs or shot glasses. And the greater aspect of this spiritual illness, as Bill Wilson calls it, centering in my mind, is the very simple fact that an alcoholic of this type cannot live without alcohol, not successfully, not happily. And if I really look at my relationship to alcohol over any considerable period of time, the truth that I see is that part of what it means for me to be an alcoholic is that I have a mind that will continue to take me back to alcohol. Every time I get released from an institution or a treatment center or a jail, historically, when I look at my relationship to booze, what I see is that I have a mind that continues to take me back to liquor. It's almost like my default program, like on a computer. And I was sponsoring this computer programmer, and this guy was so quick to point out that one of the definitions of a program, if you look it up in the dictionary, and listen to the language Bill Wilson was using in 1935, a definition of a program is a sequential set of instructions that brings about a result. Now, when you get a corrupt file in a computer, what do? You put in a recovery disk. It restores it to an earlier point in the process. Then he tells me that 10 and 11 are like the viral scan. Now, until I did the work in the Big Book, until I went through these very specific instructions, I didn't think it was interesting or humorous. And the reason was because I had confused the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous with the program for 17 years. And although they are equally important, they're not the same thing. See, the fellowship will bring me enthusiasm. It'll bring me encouragement. It'll bring me inspiration. It'll bring me hope. It'll bring me compassion. It'll bring me sympathy. It might even bring me employment in a relationship, right? But until I went through the steps for this type of alcoholic, it almost seemed like I got sicker in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I became more separate, different, and alone. And when I look back at my failure in Alcoholics Anonymous, I see today that it was my defiance towards spiritual principles, a defiance that dogs my every step. If you get a chance to read the original manuscript in Chapter 5, what it says is rarely have we seen a person fail that's thoroughly followed our directions. Now, if you're like me, I don't like directions. I hate being told what to do. I'm the type of person that will argue with anybody about anything at any time. You tell me it's black, I'll tell you it's white. You tell me it's big, I'll tell you it's small. You tell me to go left, I'll go right with an attitude. And then I'll blame you for eternity. That's why we say denial is an acronym. It stands for don't even notice I am lying. Think about it. You could tell an alcoholic, but you can't tell them much. Oh, you don't believe it? Try sponsoring somebody. And what that means for me is that you can lead me into the gates of hell, but you can't push me into heaven. And what I know today is that's why Wilson talks about attraction rather than promotion. That for an alcoholic like me, I had to get to AA on my own terms. Not because my family wanted me to, not because the penal institution wanted me to, or DCSF, or the trust fund, but because I had burned my life to the ground. And what happened is I got to one more treatment center. I was 120 pounds. Like I was saying earlier, thank God we don't look like our stories. You know, and I'm in this detox. I'm dying of alcoholism. I stink like urine. My fingers are dirty. I look like I just got out of a concentration camp, you know, and I think I got it going on. I've let everybody down one more time. And I'm in this detox with my fellow associates, you know, judging the speaker, of course. We're the only people that can be on the curb and look down at the world, right? I got two speeds, grandiose and comatose. I'm strutting around detox, bragging about robbing Brinks trucks. I do my four step. It was a bread truck. It was empty. So I'm sitting there with the shakes, with my fellow associates in the detox circle. You know, a vision for you, right? And this woman from AA comes in, and she's on her H&I committee. If you don't know what H&I is, it stands for hospitals and institutions. It's a committee that brings meetings into prisons and detoxes and treatment centers and hospitals, anywhere where clients, patients, or inmates can't get to meetings. H&I probably has the lowest relapse rate in all of recovery. Where I live on the west side of LA, we got about 300 people, you know, at this H&I meeting once a month, fighting to get at these panels. And this woman's on her H&I panel. She's doing her AA talk, and she looks us all up and down, and she says, if I could give you all the gift of recovery, I wouldn't do it. And I remember looking at her, and I looked at the guy next to me, and I said, what a bitch. And then she said something that would later change my life. She said, the reason I wouldn't give you the gift of recovery is because I wouldn't rob you of the journey. And if you're new, my experience with that journey, that gift of recovery, is almost very similar to the gift of desperation. Nobody could give me that gift of desperation. I had to have a relationship with alcohol, and I had to have a relationship with failure. Otherwise, it meant nothing to me. And I know, looking back at that experience now, if you're new, that I could write all day long on step one. Until I'd beaten down that liquor store door over and over and over again at 5:59 a.m. or paid the clerk at 7-Eleven $100 for a six-pack after they were closed, or, you know, where I live, we drive to Tijuana to get at the bars, or done all those despicable, diabolical, disgusting things that many of us do on that journey to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. You think writing about step one was going to save me? I had to have a relationship with alcohol. And looking back now at that experience, that gift of desperation is a great acronym for God. But for me as an alcoholic, I had to get to a place in my life almost where my head couldn't get enough and my body couldn't take any more. Then I kind of stood at death's door. Then I started to have a completely different relationship with alcohol. And then I started to understand what it meant to drink against my will. Then God meant something totally different to me. It meant grow or die. And I was confronted with those two choices that somehow all of us at the end of the road get. One is go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of my intolerable situation. The other, to accept spiritual help. And then it's interesting because the book talks about those not being easy choices. I mean, if you were to do a survey at, say, a Walmart or a Costco, and you said, well, you got jails, institutions, and death over here. You got happy, joyous, and free over here. It'd be like a no-brainer, right? You ask me the same question, and I'm thinking, how bad an alcoholic death? Can I talk to my counselor? And you know, when the big book talks about we have to concede to our innermost self that we're alcoholic, the word concede means to surrender with a fight. And when I look at my relationship with booze today, what I see is every alcoholic seems to defend their right to drink. And I had the same scenario that everyone else did. Fun with problems, just problems, and then I seemed to chase it for almost another decade. And it's like the disease killed me every day and it wouldn't bury me. You know, and I remember my mother seeing me go through all of those institutions. I'm an only child. She actually said to her friends, I wish he'd hurry up and die. At least he'd be out of his misery. And all of these years later, to have had the last 10 years of her life as the son that she deserved because of Alcoholics Anonymous, to be able to take her on wheelchair rides and be an AA geek and be of service and introduce her to you guys and do all those things. I got so lucky that all the stars lined up at the right time for me. It is nothing more than grace. I don't think God could possibly love the bum at 7-Eleven trying to get change tonight to get another beer any more than he does me. But I think somehow this grace is almost like an umbrella. And I have been fortunate enough to stand under that umbrella with you guys for all of these years. You know, it's almost like God will steer, but God won't row, and I kind of had to meet him halfway. If you're new, by the way, we're the only people that actually want a reward because we ran out of a burning building. You know, welcome to AA, right? I mean, if you're feeling heroic because you gave up your big Saturday night to hang out with us, this is the only place on God's earth where they'll actually applaud because you came in to save your own life. If you're sitting here thinking about drinking tonight, that beats the heck out of being in some sleazy bar thinking about getting sober. You know, if you're sitting around wondering when the miracle's going to happen, you're in AA on a Saturday night. It's happened. I was told my sobriety is God's gift to me. What I do with it is my gift to God. There's three prayers in this life. One was, God, help me. Remember saying it? I said it 1,000 times. There's another prayer, God, give me. Greatest distraction on earth. But the prayer I had never said was, God, use me. And I end up in Pathia, right? Saturday night. Really glad to be here. One of the things my sponsor asked me to do when I got sober, he said, Adam, I want you to buy a black suit. And I said, why? And he said, well, you know, unfortunately, as sad as it is, if you stick around Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going to go to a lot of funerals, like the last speaker was just talking about. Then he said something really nice. He said, oh, and by the way, if you drink again, at least we'll have something nice to bury you in. And what I've seen is if you baby the alcoholic, you'll bury him. I need to hear the truth about alcoholism, that it's fatal, it is progressive, it is chronic. We talk about jails, institutions, and death. It's kind of like hamburgers, fries, and a Coke. They go together. You know, and I don't mean to bash the therapeutic community because I believe that treatment has its rightful place. In fact, you know what all the treatment centers have in common? Just like religions, they all send their drunks to us. You know, and I really look at, you know, that relationship I had with treatment, and In some ways, I'm glad that I had that opportunity to go through that process over and over again. Because, you know, going through treatment 28 times, I mean, I started to speak a, you know, we speak a foreign language in treatment. You guys know what it is, right? It's called victimese. I don't understand how the drink bone connects to the jail bone. It's like I need a class for that, right? Oh, yeah, it's kind of like I met her in rehab. I can't believe she drank. I knew he was a crackhead. I can't believe he stole my iPhone. Met her at the strip club. Can't believe she cheated. If you're new, this is called delusion, by the way. You hear enough inventories, what the big book says is I have to see how I make decisions based on self that later leave me in a position to be hurt. If I do not connect those dots, I will always play victim. And my experience is victims don't stay sober. And as I go through this inventory, what I discover is that eventually I have to take responsibility for those decisions. It's like the seventh tradition. The spiritual significance of that is not only putting money in the basket, but for me, it has been taking personal responsibility for my recovery. And what I discovered is until I'm connecting those dots through inventory, I really didn't get the process. It's like a map. Remember those things called maps before GPS? Two things I need to know when I use a map. I got to know where I'm going, right? We all know where we're going, over there-ism. I got another disease. But I have to know where I am. And what I discovered for me is by doing these inventories over and over again, eventually what happened is I started to get emotionally separated from the events in my past that used to own me. Inventory in a peculiar way is kind of like going to the ATM machine. Now, when you go to the ATM machine, what do? You put in the card, you put in the code, you take your money, right? Real simple process. I put in the card, I put in the code, I take my money, I put in the card, and after a while, I have this huge epiphany. I get it, and I stop doing it. My friend said, why would you stop doing that? Do you realize what's going on behind the wall? And I said, no. He said, the account's being debited. See, normal people seem to be intellect over emotion. They think, they process, and they act. I seem to be exactly the opposite. I'm emotion over intellect. I act, process, and then think. Oops, 10th step. Oh, come on. We're the only people that burn bridges ahead of us. Right? If you're laughing, you're relating. And when the big book talks about having an entire psychic change, what I discovered for me after that process and continuing to live in 10, 11, and 12 is that wherever there's hysterics, there's historics. Wherever I have an emotional response, I have history. Now, I do a lot of H&I. I should, right? I'm an alumni from everywhere. And in Los Angeles, we have panels. One of the greatest illustrations of surrender I'd ever heard came out of one of the panels we have at the VA. And, you know, you get into the Veterans Administration, you know, a room full of soldiers. You know, we're running the meeting, and they ask us to, you know, pick a topic, and me being a smart ass, I pick surrender. Room gets dead quiet, right? Especially Marines. But if you ever watch a soldier surrender, like on CNN, the illustration's perfect. And if you're new, you might want to relate it to alcohol. You ever watch a soldier surrender, you'll see the soldier take the rifle, very slowly lay it on the ground, sit down on the side of the road, wait for someone to tell them what to do, right? I mean, when you got 40 AK-47s pointed at your head, you don't throw down the gun with an attitude. You're not looking back at the gun, because if you do, someone's going to shoot you. And I was asked to look at my relationship with alcohol. Because for me, it's almost like I'm in the high school gym 20 years later. The band's gone, the girls are gone, the lights are out, and I'm sitting in this cold, dark, empty room saying, where's the party? And that seems to be, for me, the peculiar mental twist, the euphoric recall, the lurking reservation, as Wilson calls it, that life had its moments, and for those very moments, I will give my life to recapture and recreate the magic that I once found in booze. And like most of us, that reservation almost killed me. It kills so many of us. It had to be smashed. And I know from my experience now that there was a big difference for me between the act of surrender that got me into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous over and over and over again as a newcomer, and the state of surrender that's keeping the old timers here. And although it sounds like the same thing, it's not. It's kind of like watching a swan glide across a pond of still water. It's so beautiful. It's so effortless. It's so graceful. But you know what that swan's doing under the water, right? He's paddling like hell. And if you're new, we have a chapter in the big book, Into Action. You ever notice there's no chapter into feelings? Right? We ought to have a chapter into thinking. How about into whining from the podium? At the noon meeting. I'm like, dude, get a job. And what happened to me, like so many of us, is I got to a place in my life where I became willing to take actions in Alcoholics Anonymous that I did not believe in. I was asked to set aside everything I thought I knew about God, about AA, about the 12 steps, so I could have a new experience with this. And I know, looking back now, that there was a direct relationship between surrender and willingness. You ever notice you'll never see anybody more willing to work this program than the guy that, you know, comes crawling into the AA clubhouse after a long, hard run? We all see him. And that was me. I would do anything. You know, first day out of detox, I get three sponsors. You know, I want to take the whole coffee pot home with me. And 30, 60, 90 days later, I'm standing at that door saying, "You mean we got to go to meetings every day?" And like a prize fighter, I would throw in the towel, and then I would take that towel back one little piece at a time. Over and over and over again. And if I really look at it now, it was the same systematic approach where what I would do is the very things that Alcoholics Anonymous had given me, the pretty girl, the big job, the nice home, were the very things that eventually became more important than Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I would do is I would build AA around my big life. And you know what happens when your life gets really big? AA becomes really inconvenient. And what I've had to do as an alcoholic in order to stay here is I've had to build my life around Alcoholics Anonymous. And it seems that the more I've invested in this simple plan of action, it's counterintuitive. The bigger my life has become. It's like Mahatma Gandhi said, "I've got so much to do today, I'm going to have to meditate twice as much." It was exactly opposite of what I thought. Willing to take actions that I didn't believe in. Now, you know, looking back at that experience, I mean, fear would not keep me sober. I don't know about you guys, but getting a third strike, living on the street, being homeless, losing my big career, throwing away my education. I don't know if anybody remembers Scared Straight, but that did not work for me. Now, it seems to work for what the doctor's opinion and Bill Wilson call the problem drinker. There's a big difference between a problem drinker and a real alcoholic. Think about it. You get a problem drinker and a real alcoholic in a jail cell, you know, for drunk driving, you get two completely different philosophies going on. You got the problem drinker over here on one side of the cell thinking, "Why did I drink so much last night? I knew I shouldn't have drank so much. Why didn't I take a taxi?" Real alcoholics on the other side of the cell thinking, "Why did I take the expressway?" I know, we have people that come from the courts. They never think that's funny. That's not funny. Right? Should have took a surface street. You could have been home cleaning your pipe tonight. Problem drinker's wife says, "Honey, if you don't stop drinking, I'm leaving you." Problem drinker cleans up his act, doesn't drink in the house, gets a little Visine. Now, if my woman says, "Honey, if you don't stop drinking, I'm leaving you," you know what I'm thinking, right? I'm thinking about single life. I mean, you want to see drama, get between an alcoholic and a drink. I mean, if you're anything like me, I mean, alcohol was the love of my life. It had me from hello. It completed me. If anything got in the way of booze, it was out of my life. You think I've been let go of the love of my life without a fight? I can't even let go of a bad relationship. Talk about detachment. Everything I like, all that's claw marks all over it. And if you're new, my relationship today with Alcoholics Anonymous has become identical. And if anything gets in the way of my recovery, it's out of my life. A woman, I don't care how beautiful she is, how much she loves me, how great it feels, how great she makes me look. I remember the first time I said that in an AA meeting, there she was in the back of the room. She's like, honey, you don't look like an alcoholic. Oh my gosh, why do you got to go to all those meetings? Oh, you're not speaking again, are you? It's the weekend, sweetie. Next thing she tells me, you know that AA thing? It's kind of getting in the way of our relationship. So a couple months later, it's the big night. I get invited to meet her parents. It's the holidays. It's Thanksgiving. So, you know, it's meet the parents night, right? I get all dressed up, suit and tie, sitting at the head of the table. Out comes the exotic wine. She's like, honey, you can have one glass of wine. Oh, come on, sweetie, it's just a glass of wine. It's the big night, honey. It's natural wine. Oh, yeah, four more rehabs. I stole her purse that night. Went down to the hood and got an outside issue. I know, and she came to detox with a get well card. Now, I don't want to get in trouble with the Al-Anons tonight. You know, I tried to send her to Codependents Anonymous. She wouldn't go. You know why? She didn't have anyone to go with. I can always tell the Al-Anons, they don't think this is funny at all. They can't even stand to see us have a good time here. Just kidding. I'm fucking terrible. I have sponsees that pay more in taxes than I earn all year. They have these huge careers and these little tiny AA programs. I've never seen one of them stand the test of time here. What do I do for a living? I stay sober. Oh, what do I do for money? That's over there. I get those two things mixed up, I'm back in handcuffs. I get those two things mixed up, I'm back in an emergency room. Or I get a doubleheader. I'm handcuffed to a gurney in an emergency room. That has consistently been my experience. I remember the day it happened. And I became famous at getting the girl, the job, the house, and the car in 90 days. And on the 91st day, I was drunk. Again and again and again. If you're new, puke smells the same in a Mercedes. And it took a long time for me to really understand that concept. To really understand the next idea that Wilson talks about, where I start to understand that self-knowledge will not fix me. I've had every relapse prevention class known to man. And I still can't make it past the liquor store. And I'm on Skid Row one more time, 5th and San Julian, drunk again, reciting chapter 5 out of the big book. And the bum next to me is like, will you shut up, man? You're ruining my high. And I'm crying because I can't get back here. Because I got a head full of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got a belly full of booze, and I'm separate, different, and alone one more time. And if you think that sounds painful, you know what could actually be worse, and I don't want to offend anybody? What could actually be worse than that is being a real alcoholic in this room tonight, not working the 12 steps. It could almost be worse. Coming to meetings late, leaving early, not having a sponsor, not having commitments, not being of service. Being in a 12-step program and not working the 12 steps, kind of like staying in a 5-star hotel and living in the bathroom. And you know what? I never understood that until I got to the other side of it. See, I know what it's like to sit in a room like this full of happy people and be so separate, different, and alone. That loneliness that is in the heart of every single alcoholic that has nothing to do with the proximity or closeness of other people. It has to do with my inability to connect with others. And I know what it's like to sit here and make a decision to drink. And you know what? I'm puking my guts out before I get to the liquor store, just with anticipation I have a complete physiological change. And you think at that point I'm going to call my sponsor? It's the last guy I'm going to call. And people say we're all the same distance from a drink. I don't believe that. See, all of my life I was one decision away from a drink. And today, between me and that decision, there's a whole world. People like you, rooms like this, commitments, service, the triangle. I mean, people say, oh, we're all the same distance from a drink. I always wonder about that. You know, you think this guy's sitting here, it's got four or five commitments, going to meetings regularly, working with a sponsor, working with sponsees, reading the book, doing service. Think he's the same distance from a drink as this guy over here that's not doing nothing? And I don't mean you. People say there's nothing I can do to keep myself sober. That may have been true when I got here. But the big book is very clear that I get a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. I better know what that means. My friend said, the longer I've been here, the less I know. What have you been doing? Now, I understand metaphorically what that means. But it also talks about nothing ensures immunity from drinking more than intensive work with others. I would assume that means if I intensively and strenuously work with others, that I got a chance at some kind of immunity. And you know what? I bought it. I believed it. My sponsor said, if you're not willing to work with other people, you're going to die. You've been drunk with commitments for years. That the work wasn't necessarily taking the steps. It was actually being rid of myself so I could take someone else through the steps. And I discovered the reason I couldn't get sober for 17 years is because I wasn't willing to give anything. That was the bottom line for me. Self-knowledge won't fix me. You know, I see now that until I really understood what the problem was, the solution wouldn't work for me. And this is not true for everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous, but it's been true for me. What the real problem for me is now, when I really look at it, was when I stopped drinking. If alcohol's the problem, the solution's not drinking. The problem with me is when I stop drinking, the outsides get better, but the insides get worse. And the longest bridge that I will ever cross, the longest journey that I will ever walk as an alcoholic, is that little tiny hyphen between the first and second half of step one. What it's really telling me is I've got a body that can't process alcohol, but more importantly, the leap is that I have a mind that cannot process reality. Those are two completely independent thoughts. Neither one has to be contingent on the other. And I had thought for years, and this is what I'd heard in the therapeutic community, because I drink, therefore my life's unmanageable. That's a half-truth. That's like looking at the ruined marriage, the broken home, the financial destitution, the failing health, and thinking that that's the problem. In fact, that's what treatment told me the problem was. Treatment told me the trigger was on the outside. Let's go learn about your triggers. I'm learning about my triggers again. I'm in class. Counselor, waking up's a trigger for me. It's like, sir, will you please go back to your dorm and button up your nightgown? See, for me, it's like looking at the tip of the iceberg. You ever notice when an alcoholic's not having a good day? You know when I'm not having a good day? When I'm not getting my way. Oh, come on, we're all like five-year-old kids here with old people's faces. Oh, you don't believe it? Cross one of us. I'll resent you for decades. And your grandkids. The problem with resentment is in Latin it means to re-feel. It means I take an event from my past, I attach emotion to it, and then I re-feel it, I rethink it, I reenact it in every area of my life. My life is like Groundhog Day. It's almost like an acid. It only eats the container it's in. So for me, when I really look at it now, what I see is the real problem is the second half of step one. And therein lies this thing. And what it is my need to play God. It is my need to be right. It is my need to sort, compare, judge, and label. It is my severe emotional overreaction to five specific things: abandonment, rejection, betrayal, disrespect, and authority. The Big Book says I am driven by 100 forms of fear. Fear of abandonment, fear of betrayal, fear of rejection, fear of disrespect, fear of authority. It's my faulty relationship with God based on self-reliance, that now that I'm not drinking, I don't need your help. It's a million miles wide. It seems to be a million miles high. But what I discover is it's paper thin. And by reaching back in my community and holding the hand of a sponsor, going through this process of admission, acknowledgement, and acceptance, through this cycle, I start to get free of it. It's almost like alcoholism is the only prison where the key's inside. And what it really comes down to is that what I try to do is I try to solve a spiritual problem with a physical solution. You guys remember Gilligan's Island? I know there's some of the crowd must remember Gilligan's Island. You ever notice that Gilligan's Island was the seven deadly sins? Think of it. The captain was gluttony. Gilligan was sloth. Marianne was envy. Ginger was lust. Mr. Howe was greed. The professor was pride. I would have killed everyone on the island but Ginger. And what I see in my life is I put down the drink, I pick up the fork. That's gluttony. Next thing you know, I'm in the mirror naked. I'm crying. I'm so fat. I can't see my feet. And I go into 6 and 7 and I say, God, please help me. Then I put down the fork and I pick up the credit card, right? Now I'm going to fix what I did with the fork. I'm in liposuction. Buying clothes. Then I'm in bankruptcy court in step 6 and 7. Saying, God, please help me. Then I put down the credit card and start acting out in the rooms. Can't go to that meeting again. You ever notice how there's a couple hundred 12-step programs and they're all identical except for the first half of step 1? And what I see in my life over and over again now is that I'm playing musical poisons in the first half of step 1, trying again and again and again to solve that spiritual problem. And what the book says is when I straighten out spiritually, only then do I straighten out mentally and physically. And what I discovered for me, and I was taught this, is that part of the word spiritual is ritual. If you're new, these unrelated actions that we take in Alcoholics Anonymous over a period of time brought about a change in my perception. Our triangle, our three legacies, recovery, unity, and service, as I talked about today, seem to translate into three specific actions: contribute, belong, and learn. Contributing is service. Belonging is unity. To learn is to uncover, discover, and discard the things in me that are blocking me. It's almost like when they asked Michelangelo, how did you make the Statue of David? Michelangelo said, I never made the Statue of David. I just chipped away everything that wasn't David, and there he was. This idea of taking these actions consistently over a period of time brought about this trinity of wisdom, power, and love. The steps bring me wisdom. The fellowship brings me power, where two or more are gathered. And somehow, by reaching back in my community, unconditionally helping another drunk, I find compassion. You know, the Big Book talks about 50% of us sobered up at once, 25% with some effort, and then there's this group that shows improvement. I was that guy. In sales, we say, don't bruise the fruit. And Wilson says that is, do not ruin a future opportunity to be helpful. Always let that guy that shows improvement know that there is love here, that there is a place for him, if and when he's ready. And if you're new, I hope you hear that, because that's what the old timers told me. If and when I was ready, the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous would always be open to me. And I'll tell you, if you're new, next to my parents, AA is the closest thing to unconditional love that a drunk like me will ever experience. No matter how many lives I destroyed, how many people I burned, how many cars I wrecked, how many despicable, horrible, humiliating, even unforgivable things that I did as an alcoholic, you guys kept that door open. And the old timers, they would say, don't even bother taking chips. Just sit in the back. Shut up. In a loving way, right? But I knew because of their kindness. So the fellowship is so important. But I had to know that there was also a plan of action, a design for living, a roadmap to spiritual success within Alcoholics Anonymous that could really bring about freedom in my life. You ever notice? I remember telling my sponsor I had a degree when I came to AA. You know what he said to me? He said, Adam, you know what? Thermometers have degrees. You know where they stick those? And I started to understand in that sick humor that at the end of the meetings where I live in Southern California, they always say, keep coming back, it works if you work it. Have you noticed they don't say, keep coming back, it works if you know it? It was only through application of these principles that the change began in me. Thinking it through doesn't work for me. I love it when they say, oh, just play the tape through. I mean, that seems to work for some people. I play the tape through. I'm driving my brand new car down the freeway past Skid Row. You know what my head tells me? Oh, Skid Row wasn't that bad. That's insanity. If you're new, that is the insanity that I live with. I had always thought insanity was doing the same thing and expecting different results. Isn't that what you hear in AA? That is not the insanity I live with. I have a completely different brand of insanity. It's doing the same thing, knowing exactly what's going to happen and what. Doing it anyway. Oh, come on, at least the other kind of insanity, doing the same thing and expecting different results, at least there's some hope there. And what that shows me is the true nature of powerlessness. I mean, I know there's a don't drink no matter what club in AA, and I have a great respect for you guys. But my book said, and I've seen it in my own experience, that I could not bring into my consciousness with sufficient force the pain and suffering of a week or a month ago. That I have no effective mental defense against the first drink. What that's telling me is a guy like me will take my first drink completely sober, with what I think is a sound mind, because I live in delusion. I have that peculiar blind spot. So when I hear don't drink no matter what I translate that into now is work the steps no matter what, maintain commitments no matter what, reach back and help other alcoholics in my community no matter what, and there I am again in a state of grace. I am under that umbrella. And I know now that the shower I took yesterday won't keep me clean today. When Wilson says I cannot rest on my laurels, it means I cannot stay sober on past accomplishments. It's like unplugging a refrigerator. You know what happens when you unplug a refrigerator, right? Everything goes bad. I mean, I don't want to offend anybody here, but to pick up a drink, for me, it's kind of like having sex with a gorilla. Oh, when you have sex with a gorilla, honey, it's not over till the gorilla says it's over, right? Get that gorilla back in the cage, it starts looking at you again with those loving eyes. I promise I won't hurt you this time. Oh, come on. Remember how it used to be, just me and you? No one's going to know. We're in Mexico. This is the kind of delusion that I live in. Reminds me of this guy. He gets a rifle for his birthday, and his lifelong ambition was he wants to shoot a polar bear. He's a hunter. So he flies up to the tundra, and he sees these bears, and he shoots this bear, and he's looking at his kill, and tap on his shoulder. It's a bigger polar bear looking down at him. You just shot my son. You get two choices. You either let me have my way with you, or I'm going to maul you to death. A couple weeks later, he's healing up in the hospital. Now he's got a resentment. So he gets better, he gets back on the plane, he goes up to the tundra, he sees the bear, he takes his shot, he's overlooking at his kill, tap on his shoulder, bigger polar bear looking down at him. You just shot my uncle. You get two choices, you either let me have my way with you, or I'm going to maul you to death. Back in the hospital, healing up again, another resentment. This goes on for years. back and forth, back and forth. One day he's up there, he takes the shot, he's looking at this bear, tap on his shoulder. It's the king of the polar bears looking down at him. The bear says, "You know, we've been watching you. You're not really up here for the hunting, are you?" If you don't think it relates, there's a section in the big book called The Jaywalker. And that is not so far-fetched if I really look at my relationship with alcohol. The big book says I am driven by selfishness, driven by resentment, driven by dishonesty. It's like the four horsemen that drive cattle. They drive it to the slaughterhouse. And until I'm able to see that, I seem to be a prey to misery and depression. A friend of mine was talking about being in a hotel just like this, and he's standing up on one of the balconies. He's looking down at this beautiful shoreline, and there's a strip of water that goes out on the shore, and he's talking to one of the guys that works in the hotel, and he says, "What is that?" They're in Mexico, and he says, "Oh, it's a riptide." And he says, "It's the worst thing in the world. Every year we lose like 10 or 11 tourists. They get caught in this riptide. And even though they're great swimmers, they fight and they fight and they fight. And they get tired and they just succumb to it. They drown." And he says, "Well, that's ridiculous. It's only a couple feet wide. It just goes out a few yards. Why don't they just let go?" Having had a spiritual awakening, a psychic change like so many of us, somehow now I'm able to see that. I'm able to see my self-will. I'm able to see my delusion. I'm able to recognize my dishonesty, my selfishness. I mean, you hear it in chapter 5. I know we didn't read chapter 5 in any of the meetings I was in, but in Southern California, they read chapter 5 in every single meeting. It's like, you know, that's when people kind of go into text mode. But at the end of chapter 5, the part that we read, it talks about our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that I'm an alcoholic and I cannot manage my own life. B, that probably no human power can relieve my alcoholism. And C, that God could and would have sought. And I'm thinking, before and after what? What are they talking about? And it was pointed out to me before and after I stopped drinking. See, the problem drinker comes in here and thinks the unmanageability is based on his drinking. If it's true, stop drinking. A lot of the guys that I got drunk with, a lot of guys I grew up with, as soon as they put down the drink, everything works for them. They fit in, they're part of, the career welcomes them back, they come to meetings once a year, never work a step, and their life gets consistently better. They've been serene since their ass hit the seat in AA. That's not my experience. My experience, every time I put the drink down, the first thing they say to me is, "Boy, you need to be on medication. Why are you so angry? Why are you so emotional? What's wrong with you? Why can't you sit still back there?" And I'm crying at dog food commercials. See, when I'm not drinking, I have a whole other set of problems. They're outlined on page 52 of the big book. When I'm not drinking, I'm a prey to misery and depression. When I'm not drinking, I can't control my emotional nature. When I'm not drinking, I can't manage my personal relationships. Sound familiar? When I'm not drinking, I'm full of fear. When I'm not drinking, I'm of no use to other people. When I'm not drinking, I'm basically unhappy. And the way that plays out for me in untreated alcoholism is I don't fit in, I'm not part of, you don't understand me, everybody's in my way, life's not fair, they're not treating me right, they're not paying me enough, for goodness sake, she's cheating on me, I got a drink. And something magic happens. As soon as I pick up a cocktail, I intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle me. Come on, give me two or three more drinks. Fear of people and economic insecurity leave me. I'm buying the whole bar drinks. Hell, I'll write you a check. Not only are you getting better looking, honey, I'm getting better looking. Give me a couple Vicodin, I could comprehend the word serenity and I know peace. Give me a little cocaine, I want to start a business with you. See, alcohol creates the illusion that my life is manageable. And one of the things my sponsor asked me to do is he asked me to substitute. Like, if you look at the promises, it says we suddenly realize that God could do for us what we could not do for ourselves. My sponsor said, plug alcohol into that equation. didn't some of us see that alcohol had done for us what we could not do for ourselves? And then the next leap was, he said, there's a relationship between God and alcohol. You get into the ghettos in this country where everything's been burned to the ground, there's always two things that somehow stick out: churches and liquor stores. You know why? Because they both give man hope. And what I didn't understand is hope doesn't matter to a drunk like me until I become hopeless. That seems to be the catalyst. It doesn't matter to someone like me until I burned my life to the ground. Think about it. Alcohol is classified by the AMA as a depressant. 9 out of 10 people, they have a couple drinks. They say stuff like, whoa, I got to slow down. I'm feeling it. I have a couple drinks and honey, I want to get married. Couple drinks, I'm trying to go to Vegas, right? I'm looking for the car keys I hid for myself. See, for me, alcohol is a stimulant. And that seems to be what makes me bodily and mentally different from my fellows. It's not how much I drink, it is not how often I drink, but the effect produced in me is so elusive that I cannot differentiate the true from the false. Alcohol does so much for me, I don't care what it's doing to me. And that's what the earth people don't understand about us, or the Al-Anons. They can't figure out why we drink, we can't figure out why you don't. Well, now you know. Carl Jung sent a letter to Bill Wilson relating spirits to spirituality. And what I discovered for me is that alcohol is an artificial means to a spiritual experience. If you're new, my experience with the steps now is that the 12 steps are a practical means to a spiritual experience. Chuck C. said, the real problem here isn't alcohol. He said, the real problem is a conscious separation from God. And then he points to the 11th step where he talks about the solution, conscious contact with God. And for me, the solution was 4 through 9. That was the bridge from 2 to 11. Maybe what they should say in AA is, rarely have we seen a person fail that's done steps 4 through 9, right? Rarely have we ever seen anybody do 4 through 9. I consistently do that AA waltz. 1, 2, 3, drink. 1, 2, 3, drink. 1, 2, 3, drink. And I'll turn my will and life over to anything but that which will solve my problem. I mean, you want to hide something from a newcomer, you know where to put it, right? Stick it in the big book. They'll never find it. I tell people the big book's making a big comeback in AA. Talks about me being the actor, trying to be the director, trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and all the players, if everyone would do as I wished. And what I see in that scenario when I look back at it now is that somehow I had given God a role in my play. And when God didn't meet my finite human expectations, I consciously or subconsciously became separated from that God. And like I said earlier today, you tell a 5-year-old kid, go in your room and straighten out your room, he doesn't want to do it. You tell that same little kid, go in your room and throw out all your old stuff and we'll buy you new stuff. How long would that take? And if you're new, when my sponsor said, how free do you want to be? I was so lucky that I was fresh out of plans. I was so lucky that I didn't have another answer. And he said, what do you want from AA? You keep coming through these rooms over and over again. Every time you get beat up, you come through AA. And I had grown up in Malibu. And I said, I want a yacht and a Learjet. Because I thought it was an outside job. And you know what he said to me? He said, if you work steps 4 through 9 and you consistently live in 10, 11, and 12, what you'll get, because I'm a taker, right? I'm here to get something. He says, what you'll get is a quiet mind and a loving heart. And I looked at him and I thought, what do I want that for? But think about what the opposite of a quiet mind is. It's a mind that won't shut up. It's a mind that's up at 3 a.m. saying, don't even bother getting a job. They're going to do the background check on you. Those people in AA don't love you. It's up 5 minutes before me every day. And the opposite of a loving heart is a vindictive heart. It's a prejudiced heart. It's a resentful heart. All of my life, I'd been crucified between two thieves, yesterday and tomorrow. And yesterday, I have guilt, shame, and remorse. And tomorrow, I have fear, anxiety, and worry. And it seems like that process of continuing to take inventory, like that ATM machine, as I continue to process through inventory, I become emotionally separated from the events in my past that used to own me. It is a phenomenon that happens for so many of us. I continue, and then I do it with others. And as a result of that, I'm able to navigate around the drama. I'm able to match calamity with serenity. I'm able to stay in fit spiritual condition. Being a newcomer for 17 years, I know it's a hard thing to say, but it's almost like purgatory. I lived in a state of purgatory. And it reminds me of this story, a very old story in AA, about this guy's in purgatory, and, you know, the angel appears. And he says, well, what do you want to see first, heaven or hell? And he says, well, let me see hell first. So he goes into this room, and there's this beautiful banquet table. And around this banquet table, there's about 50 people, and they're sitting in these huge armchairs. And there's every kind of lavish food you could possibly imagine. And they're sitting in these armchairs, and they've got this 4-foot-long silverware duct taped to their arms. And they're strapped to these chairs so they can't feed themselves. And they're like, you can see the anguish and the starvation. And they're there for eternity. That's hell. He says, that's awful. Let me see heaven. And he walks into the next room, and it's exactly the same banquet table. All this beautiful food, same 50 people around the table, strapped to these armchairs with this 4-foot-long silverware taped to their hands so they can't feed themselves. And he's looking at it, and he can see that they're smiling and they're nourished. And he doesn't really get it. And then one of them moves, and he realizes the only difference between heaven and hell is that in heaven they're feeding each other. And when we talk about selfishness, self-centeredness, that is the root of our trouble. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-pity, I step on the toes of my fellows and they retaliate. It talks about these problems being of my own making and that I don't think it is because I live in delusion. And my experience now is all service. It's almost like the highest spiritual discipline is service. And it's the first thing they asked me to do in AA. Get a commitment, reach back in my community, help another drunk. What happened to me when I came out of that 28th treatment center, the guy that was running the detox said, why don't you come back to detox next week and tell everybody in detox how you stayed sober a whole week if you can make it. And for the next 8 years, I sat in 3 hours of bumper-to-bumper traffic every Thursday night to tell the guys in detox how I stayed sober a whole week. And I was tricked into service. You know, a friend of mine used to say that AA is kind of like football. Now, in football, you got fans and you got players, right? Here, the players are the ones that set up all these nice chairs. They're the ones that bring the literature. They're the ones that make the coffee. They're the ones that secretary the meetings. Then you got fans. They're the ones that take the literature, take the coffee, take the chairs. And my friend said, you know, AA is the most dangerous spectator sport in the world. If you're new, we encourage you to get involved. Get involved in this thing. And like I said before, when I look back at my life, the reason I couldn't get sober for all those years was very simply because I wasn't willing to give anything. And I never knew how free I could be. In closing, if someone did to me what I did to myself, I would have killed them. If someone did to me what I did to others, I would have killed them. And then I come to AA, and you want me to pray to God? I didn't want God to find out where I was. I'd become bankrupt in those three relationships. And as I said earlier today, the steps remedied those three relationships. Steps 1 through 3 recreated and developed a relationship with God. 4 through 7 recreated and developed a relationship with self. 8 and 9 recreated and developed a relationship with others. 10 maintained and developed my relationship with self. 11 maintains and develops my relationship with God. And 12 through service maintains, develops, and grows my relationship with others. So coming out of the steps, I'm able to live in harmony in those simple, fundamental relationships. relationships. There was a great spiritual teacher. He was asked, what's the most important thing of all your teachings? What did he say? Love God with all thy heart, love thy neighbor as thyself. And if God scares you out of these rooms and you're a real alcoholic, don't worry about it. Booze will scare you back in. Einstein said, I would rather live my life pretending there's a God and finding out there isn't than live my life pretending there's no God and finding out there is one. It was just that simple for me. There's a poem in Notre Dame. It says, I sought my God I could not see. I sought my soul I could not free. I sought my brother, and I found all three. And now I know when they talk about nothing ensures immunity from drinking more than intensive work with others. That was the key. The first thing they ask us to do here. One of the oldest stories in AA is about this little five-year-old kid, and he wants to play with his dad. He's five, and the dad's like an accountant. He's busy, and he's trying to occupy this little boy. So what the dad does is he gets this map of the world. You know, National Geographic, they have those wonderful maps, and he rips this map up into like 50 pieces, and he gives it to his son, and he gives the little boy some tape, and he says, what I want you to do is I want you to put this map of the world back together, and when you're done, we'll play. And he's thinking it's going to take the kid an hour. Little five-year-old comes back in 3 minutes. He's got the whole map of the world taped back together. The dad's like, that's impossible. I'm 50. How did you do that? The little boy says, you know, Dad, on the back of the map of the world, there was a picture of a man. I just put the man back together, and the whole world fell into place. If you're new, that seems to be the spiritual technology of Alcoholics Anonymous. In 1 through 3, I give it up. 4 through 7, I clean it up. 8, 9, I make it up. 10, 11, and 12, I keep it up. And as a result of that simple process, for me, like so many, I mean, my life's so good, there should be background music, you know? And I know the newcomers get upset when they hear that. And it doesn't mean that I don't live with unresolved problems. What it means is that we have a design for living. And someone had asked today what that fourth dimension really is. It is my ability now to separate the spiritual from the material. And by doing that, I get to stay in a place of neutrality. That's what it did for me. It shows me how to navigate around the drama, to match calamity with serenity, and to stay in a fit spiritual condition so I can reach back in my community and help others. If there was a definition of hell, it would probably be if God were to show me all the things I might have accomplished if I'd only believed in myself. And if you're new and you can't believe in yourself, believe in the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. Believe in this fellowship. Believe in the old timers here that have walked this path before us. When I'm having a bad day, I need a meeting. When I'm having a great day, a meeting needs me. And that's why we're here tonight. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Adam.